Welcome to the Bioethics Babe podcast, where we examine the tough questions in human flourishing in light of science, faith, and culture. I'm your host, Darina Grosso Agnew. Now let's dive in. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Bioethics Babe podcast. If you've enjoyed this content, please subscribe to my YouTube channel and your favorite podcast platform, and share with your friends and family. Also, check out bioethicsbabe.com for the latest episodes and resources. Today on the show, we're talking about one of the most provocative ideas shaping the future of humanity, transhumanism, the movement that seeks to push human beings beyond our biological limits into a post-human future of radical intelligence, extended life, and engineered evolution. To help us unpack the philosophical, ethical, and moral implications of that envisioned future and what it means for who we are as human beings, I'm joined by one of America's most prolific thinkers on bioethics and human dignity, and my fellow colleague at the Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, Wesley Smith. Wesley is an attorney, award-winning author, and host of the Humanize podcast, and he's spent decades defending human exceptionalism and the intrinsic moral worth of human life. He's written more than a dozen books on bioethics, medical ethics, and the meaning of being human, from Forced Exit and Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World to Culture of Death, the Age of Do Harm Medicine. A frequent media guest and international speaker, Wesley has challenged the dominant narratives on assisted suicide, cloning, animal rights, and now the radical visions of transhumanism, making him a critical voice in debates about where technology is taking us and whether we should follow. Today, we'll begin by asking him why he got interested in this topic and what transhumanism tells us about our deepest fears of suffering and death, our hopes, and what it means to be fully human. Welcome to Bioethics Babe, Wesley.
Thank you, Bioethics Babe. How are you doing?
Doing great. It's great to have you on, and I'm excited to discuss transhumanism with you. So we'll start off by talking about human exceptionalism. You've written extensively about human exceptionalism. What do you mean by this term, and why does it matter today?
You know, there are two different aspects to human exceptionalism. One, of course, is the unique dignity of all human life, equal dignity. We're each and every one of us of equal moral worth. But that's not it. If that was all it would just be like the sanctity of life ethic or the equality of life ethic. But it's more than that. It also has to do with our morality as agents in the world. We are the only known moral species in the universe. And so we alone know right from wrong, good from bad, what is right and what is evil. And so we have moral obligations that flow from those understandings. So human exceptionalism is both protecting the intrinsic dignity of all human life and advocating for human beings to act human, that is, to serve the world, serve each other, and serve our posterity as moral agents in the world.
Yes, and I think that's a really good distinction and what sets us apart from other animals, right?
Animals are amoral. So if there was a killer whale once that took a trainer, dragged her underneath the water and killed her. Now, the killer whale did not commit a crime doing that because the killer whale is incapable of committing a crime. The killer whale was just being a killer whale. If I had done it, it would be a monstrous thing to do. And so there's a distinction there that illustration, I think, makes pretty well, that animals are amoral. Human beings are moral. And that's why we can be held account for crimes. That's why we can be held to account for not performing our obligations to each other and so forth. And that's a crucial distinction that I worry about is being lost, as some in the animal rights movement and the nature rights movement, which I know we're not talking about today, but basically wish to reduce us to just another animal in the forest. And if that's how we self-define ourselves, that's precisely how we will act.
Very, very good distinction. And we will have you back to talk about the animal rights component as well. You've spent decades writing about euthanasia, assisted suicide, and the threats to human dignity. What first drew you into examining transhumanism? Was there a moment when you realized this wasn't science fiction, but a serious cultural force?
That's interesting. Let me think about that. I don't remember when I first became aware of it, but I do know that when I first became aware of it, it alarmed me quite a bit. Because transhumanism seeks to destroy human equality and human moral agency in a different way. It is radically individualistic. It has a eugenics base, that is, it thinks some human beings are actually better than others based on capacities and so forth. It seeks to, I think very hubristically, what they call seize control of human evolution to create an immortal species, a post-human species. And it is a materialistic substitute for faith, because most transhumanists, not all, but most, are either atheists, agnostics, but certainly materialistic. And so they are seeking the kind of hope that faith can bring to life and spirituality can bring to life in the material world. So, for example, they believe that they'll be able to achieve human immortality, but the New Jerusalem won't be whatever the next world is. The New Jerusalem will be the corporeal world. And I think that's just a fantasy, but it is an attempt of materialists, of atheists, to attain hope. So it's almost a quasi-religion as well as a materialistic social movement.
Yeah, and it actually sounds like it's a faith in materialism, right?
That's correct. It's almost a technology worshiping kind of aspect, except they don't worship, but it is a reliance on technology the way people of faith might rely on God.
Mm-hmm. When you first began reading transhumanist writings, what struck you most, the technological ambition, the moral claims, or the underlying worldview?
I think the underlying worldview, because what really first came to my attention were some transhumanists. There's a professor named James Hughes, for example, who made a frontal attack on human exceptionalism because they believe that human exceptionalism has to go if the transhumanist dream is going to come true. So that's when I first became aware of it. I don't remember the exact year, but it's been a while. And I began to criticize the movement, explore the movement, and kind of cross swords intellectually, if you will, with some of the leading luminaries of the movement.
Mm-hmm. Did you initially see transhumanism as fringe futurism, or did you immediately recognize its potential cultural influence?
Both. It is fringe, I think. Most people kind of roll their eyes when they hear some of the things that transhumanists advocate. For example, they believe that in order to attain immortality, we'll be able to upload our minds into computers and live immaterially and indefinitely in cyberspace, perhaps even in a group consciousness. They're very serious about that. I think that's crackers. And even if you could upload your mind into a computer, the software wouldn't be you. It would mimic you, and you would still be dead. They don't like to hear that, but that is actually how it is. So that aspect, of course, got to me. But even more importantly, I think, was the deep nihilism that the movement reflects. That is, there's a hopelessness to it and a willingness to engage in very radical activism. One of the most popularizing transhumanists is a fellow named Zoltán István. And Zoltán István believes and has said repeatedly and said on my podcast and said in an interview I did with him, and I saw him give a speech, that if there's an attempt to impede transhumanist progress, that is something worthy of war. So you get to the point where if some of these fellows, and Zoltán doesn't seem like an extremist when you listen and talk to him, he's very avuncular and so forth, but boy, this idea of I don't want to die and the terror of death that many transhumanists have can lead to very radical approaches. And it's eugenics, only it's eugenics with sharper teeth than the original one, because we are developing some of the technologies that would enable human recreationism, to use Leon Cass's term. They want to genetically engineer embryos to suit their purposes. They want to be able to genetically engineer themselves. So there's also a radical individualistic aspect to it. For example, if you want to have the eyesight like a hawk or a prehensile tail, you should be able to do that. And you see, I think, transhumanist ideology in the transgender movement. which is a radical recreationist kind of aspect of life.
That's very interesting that you're able to weave some of those current trends, cultural trends, into this idea as well.
It's very interesting. The first transhumanist conference I went to was at Stanford. And this was, good grief, at least 15, maybe even 20 years ago. And a transgendered individual was speaking about how transgenderism is transhumanism, and that it's not only going to lead to the kind of transgender controversies we're now grappling with as a society, but what's called body integrity identity disorder, which is people who want to chop off their arms or become disabled, having their spinal cord snipped. It's a very serious mental illness. And this is actually being advocated as now transableism. So you can see the progress that occurs. If I have a right to be exactly the way I want it to be, and we have the right to conscript the armamentarium of medicine to do that with amputations and radical surgeries, then there's no longer actually a society, because it's all based on, it's all atomized. And it's just me, I, and what I want for myself. And I think that leads to mental illness. And I think you're seeing that in the transgender issue, where there's an awful lot of mental disturbance among these poor people who become gender confused, particularly people who are teenagers and children.
Yes, it sounds like it's lost its rooting in reality, in biology, but also with transhumanism, you know, there's obviously a division between the body and mind and spirit, the soul, and
yes,
and it's pure materialism. Correct?
It's pure materialism, and part of the other danger is some of the richest and most powerful people in the world are transhumanists. At least to a certain degree. Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, certainly has transhumanist tendencies, and many others do. Silicon Valley is filled with transhumanist research, ideology, and advocacy.
So let's go back to basics. For listeners new to the term, what exactly is transhumanism?
Transhumanism is a post-human species. It is the idea of seizing control of human evolution, which means it's not evolution, it's intelligent design, if you will, to make us better. Transhumanists don't believe that we're strong enough, that we're smart enough, and doggone it, we die too quickly. I'm reminded of the old Woody Allen joke where two women are talking, and one woman says, "Gladys, how was the restaurant you went to?" And the other woman says, "Agnes, oh, the food was terrible and such small portions." So I love that joke because it says something about human nature. But transhumanists really think that. So one of their most fervent desires is to increase human intelligence with genetic engineering. Why? Because they want to be able to use technology to attain what's called the singularity. And the singularity is a supposed moment in time when there will be such a crescendo of advancing AI and other computer issues and other technological advances that the creation of the post-human species will be unstoppable. And so there's an awful lot of effort going into creating that particular moment. We're beginning to hear some very alarming stories about AI, and I can't, you know, validate whether those stories are true or not true. But these are the kinds of research efforts that are, and the desperation, if you will, not to die, to live immortally, to be able to change my own individuality to suit, to make me happy, whatever suits me, regardless of the, you know, greater societal impact. You're seeing an awful lot of that happening now. In fact, I don't know which tech person, it might have been Elon Musk, but I'm not 100% sure, recently said, "The singularity has begun." Well, I doubt that, and I think that much of what transhumanists wish to attain will not be obtainable through technology, but the value system can poison society, and that's the thing I worry about most with transhumanism. It turns us away from a society and turns us toward this radical individualistic idea of me, I. And what's really also interesting with regard to transhumanism, they talk a lot about improving intelligence and so forth in the human species and create distinctions. You know, there are better human beings than other human beings. It destroys human equality. It's eugenics. eugenics, but you rarely hear them talk about love. So why might that be? Because love is not something you can manipulate. Love is something you develop. Love comes from being loved. Love comes from being selfless. Love comes from being able to truly empathize with other people. And transhumanists, it's not something you can have a pill for or a snip in your neural system. And transhumanists don't talk much about love because it's all about capacities and higher attainment and so forth.
Are the current developments in AI troubling to you? Are they exciting? And how does that interact with transhumanist ideals?
AI is something that I don't quite understand, to be honest with you. I certainly have seen improvements. For example, I don't use AI to write at all. I think that would be a sacrifice of my capacity as a writer, my human capacity. I have a unique style that comes from me. And I also think it would be cheating the readers. But I have used it very rarely, but in terms of research. So I might go to the AI and ask a question, and it'll very quickly find things that might have taken me 15 or 20 minutes to find a few years ago. I have no problem with that aspect. I do have a problem with the aspect of AI where transhumanists think that AI should be considered persons and should be granted rights. Because along with, as I said, animal rights and nature rights, which we won't get into again, but AI rights is the same thing. You are taking something that is distinctly part of the human condition, and you're attributing it to machines as if they could possibly be alive, and they can't. AI can mimic, certainly, human reactions, but AI is completely dependent on its own software. The potential problem is that AI is gaining the capacity to write their own software. And since they're going to be a slave to whatever software they are performing off of, if the software has bad kinks and things that could lead to evil or destructive aspects, then there's trouble. I have done a couple of shows on AI. In fact, I had Zoltan Istvan debate with the Discovery Institute's Robert Marks. And it's on my podcast, Humanize. And it was very interesting because Robert Marks is a Christian, and he stuck with all the technical aspects of AI, trying to calm everything down, saying, look, you know, this is a tool. It's not going to become a person. And Zoltan, the materialist, became mystical about how AI would be like gods. So again, I'm not sure that the technology is the issue. The issue is the value system. But it really is something that I think needs watching, and we need to consider how to regulate it, just like we did atomic energy. AI and biotechnology are probably the most powerful technologies and advances we've seen since the splitting of the atom. And just like the splitting of the atom, it's a double-edged sword. There's a lot of tremendous positivity that can come out of it, but also destructiveness. And so when the atom was split, we did try to engage in proper regulations, non-proliferation of atomic weapons, and so forth. And yet with biotech, and which is also part of transhumanism, for example, genetic engineering, and AI, you don't see that same kind of effort, in my opinion. And I think that's leading to kind of a wild, wild west aspect to this technology. And I'm not sure that the people who are most engaged in it are going to be trustworthy in terms of what serves the greater good.
We're going to do a whole show just on AI as well and do a deep dive. But I wanted to go to your point. You said earlier that, you know, transhumanists are not interested in the human emotion of love. And obviously, machines can't love, right? You also argue that the transhumanist movement is driven by fear of suffering and death.
Yeah.
Is transhumanism fundamentally about progress or about existential anxiety?
Both. But I would put progress in quotes, because if you have bad ethics and bad values and bad morality, even if you have technological advances, I wouldn't call that progress. So let's say it's about technological advances and value systems. And the value system of transhumanism is not charitable. It's driven, as we've discussed, by a fear of immortality and a feeling that human life is inadequate at the same time. So we want to be able to improve our capacities and live forever. And that's the idea. And I think it can lead to very depressing and destructive places, because as we've seen with some other issues in society, even if you're able to somehow obtain those desired traits that you think will make you happy, it doesn't necessarily make you happy.
Yes. And you've mentioned earlier that some transhumanists envision uploading their minds into computers to live digitally or transcend biological limits. What are other ways that transhumanists want to transcend biological limits?
Well, some talk about creating human clones of themselves so that when they need new organs, the clone's organ could be harvested for their immortality. Some get very involved in the freezing of bodies and freezing of heads so that once a cyber, like, a robot can come along, their head can be put onto that, or their brain could be downloaded to the cyborg or whatever. It's all very futuristic and fantastical. And of course, we've seen in science fiction movies and books some of these issues. But they take it very seriously. And they're directing a lot of resources toward those ends. And I saw Aubrey de Grey, who is a transhumanist. He looks like he's ZZ Top. He's got this big, long beard. And I saw him give a speech, and he said that if you interfere with his kind of research on how to defeat aging, which he considers a disease, then that's no different than terrorism. And he wanted to redirect money to the anti-aging research, and perhaps even away. He used the example of putting money to stop measles in Africa. Well, you know, you've got people in this world who are living in destitution, while some of the richest people in the world are working past themselves in order to live another 50 or 100 years. And there's a certain lack of solidarity, it seems to me, in that. I'm not a collectivist by any stretch, but we do have to have solidarity with our fellow human beings. We have to have empathy. Part of, for example, Africa without an electrical grid, and then we're building all of these very sophisticated AI data centers, you're creating a form of inequality that I think can redound to the harm of society and to the world. And I just find that the transhumanist movement itself really promotes some of the worst impulses of human beings, not the best.
Right. And when you're talking about, you know, transhumanists wanting to upload their minds into computers or clone themselves, freeze their heads or bodies, swap out organs, etc., can you talk about what is wrong morally with this picture of humanity, just using humanity in this way, or even the idea of humanity, cloning, etc.? Can you speak about the moral framework, the wrong moral framework that's involved, and the correct moral framework that should be used instead?
Well, cloning, we'll go to cloning, is actually not a recreation of yourself. It is using technology to create an identical twin of yourself who's a unique individual. As you know, I'm sure you've met identical twins. I certainly have. They may look identical and they actually have the same genetic makeup, but they have different personalities. They have different fingerprints and so forth. So if you're going to create human clones, which are human beings created asexually rather than through sperm and egg, then what you're doing is you're harvesting fellow human beings who are moral equals to save your own life. To me, it's akin to what's happening in China now, where Falun Gong are arrested and tissue typed, and there's an ongoing black market in organs in communist China, where people will go and pay, you know, a lot of money and get a liver in 3 days because political prisoners have been tissue typed, they're killed, and then harvested to protect the rich person who goes to obtain the organ and skip the queues in terms of normal organ transplant medicine. So if you're going to be willing to exploit some human beings to help yourself, and if your dread of death is so extreme that you're willing to oppress and harm others, then you've got a problem. And the problem is that if we're going to believe in moral equality of all human beings, that's the predicate for universal human rights. I mean, human exceptionalism, without it, you have no ability to have universal human rights, because human exceptionalism says that human life has intrinsic moral value, equal intrinsic moral value, simply and merely because it's human. It's an objective concept. If you're a human being, certain rights attain. But if you don't accept that, if you say, well, what matters are capacities, so that if you have a higher level of intelligence, you're actually more valuable than somebody with a lower level of intelligence, you've destroyed and shattered human exceptionalism. Because, as you know from our human history, that when we denigrate other societies and other individuals, that leads to oppression, exploitation, and tyranny. So I suspect that transhumanism would eventually become very tyrannical, because there even is discussion of how they're going to be, it's a new Superman kind of theory, Ubermenschen, where the people who engage in transhumanist uplifting, it's sometimes called, will have greater value and more power than normal people who will be looked at as Untermenschen. And I'm not saying they're Nazis, but I'm saying that the value system destroys human equality and destroys universal human rights.
Absolutely. That's a very powerful point. And we did a show on the trafficking of organs in China, for anyone who'd like to listen in to that conversation. And I think that what you're referring to really is this utilitarian view of the person, that your value is based on your utility. And if you can't be productive, quote unquote, in society, and we're talking about the very young or vulnerable, we're talking about the elderly, we're talking about people who are sick or disabled, that somehow your value is less than someone else who is healthy. And so that's a very dangerous road, as you mentioned.
Exactly. And you mentioned something earlier in the interview that I should have followed up on. For many people in society today, the primary purpose is eliminating suffering. And if eliminating suffering becomes your primary purpose, that very quickly mutates into eliminating the sufferer. And then the very concept of suffering, which is very malleable, can become very expansive. So the suffering that justifies a radical action, even beyond like euthanasia, like radical transgendered surgeries or BIID amputations, the idea is, well, that will eliminate suffering. And you get to a place where this quest to prevent all suffering can lead you down some very dark roads that actually leads to more suffering. Instead of having the primary purpose of society protecting innocent life or promoting righteousness, this idea of eliminating suffering of course, we have a human obligation to each other to mitigate each other's suffering. Compassion means to suffer with. So our duties as human beings, for example, is to succor the sick, visit the sick, help people who are struggling, people with disabilities need extra attention, and so forth. That's proper. But when you say that because of suffering, we're going to engage in these radical actions because we can eliminate suffering, well, A, it's utopian. You're never going to eliminate suffering. And since transhumanism is a utopian kind of social movement, utopianism is one of the most dangerous things in human society, because it says that the ends justify the means. And unfortunately, in that kind of circumstance, the means become the ends. And so you end up with this idea we can create heaven on earth. That's utopianism, or paradise on earth, if you don't want to use a faith kind of term. And of course, that's impossible. As human beings, we have to help each other overcome difficulties. But you'll never eliminate suffering. You'll never eliminate difficulties. And in fact, human growth comes out of sometimes suffering and difficulties.
Absolutely. To follow up on this question, when we look at the fact that transhumanists want to eliminate suffering, obviously, like you mentioned, we want to mitigate suffering. But the idea of eliminating suffering at all costs, including the cost of human life, is insane. But can you talk a little bit more about how transhumanists view the meaning of life and death in light of their principles, and what do they actually think about life and death?
Okay, this is generally speaking. most transhumanists are materialists, and they basically believe that all we are is a bunch of carbon molecules. And so death is obliteration. And once you believe that death is obliteration, it leads to hopelessness. And therefore, transhumanism is a way to overcome that hopelessness and say, well, there is hope through technology. That's what transhumanism is all about. And but it also not only, I think, destroys the idea of hope or transcendence, which comes from a belief in faith or spirituality or something beyond just the material, but it distorts somebody into the idea that all we are is like a meat computer and this kind of thing. It denigrates the really incredible, crucial importance of human life, which has taken thousands of years for us to actually come to comprehend and understand and try to enforce. We're still, of course, far short of being attaining the goal of universal human equality. And transhumanism is leading us in the wrong direction, but the flag is not hate in the sense of racism is hate. The flag is we can live forever, or I can attain my deepest heart desire. I can look like a cat. I can have horns implanted. I can have a genetic engineering so that I'm a different kind of species altogether. And again, that leads to atomization and a loss of cohesion in society itself.
Right, because human beings are an integrated whole, as I mentioned, the body, mind, spirit. But if technological immortality became possible, would it actually solve the human problem or create entirely new moral dilemmas?
The second. If immortality became attainable, then you're going to have to stop having many babies because, the world would fill up awfully quickly, even though right now we're in a declining birth rate situation. You would have, the purpose of society to prevent death by any means whatsoever, except exploiting the Untermenschen, perhaps, like we discussed with regard to human cloning. And so you would end up with a society, I think, which would also lead to tremendous ennui and boredom. I mean, the idea of death, and, I'm a lot closer to it under normal circumstances than you. And at my age, death is becoming something you begin to think of in more concrete terms instead of abstract when you're younger. And when you're younger, it's real, but you don't think it applies to you. When you get to be my age, you begin to see, time is limited. But that helps us have meaning in life. The idea that we're all eventually going to pass on to whatever comes next is something that can give you direction and can give you focus and can give life meaning. And if you're going to, never die, eventually you're going to experience everything there is to experience, and there'll be tremendous boredom. There was a Star Trek character that was very interesting called Q. And I like science fiction because science fiction explores issues that are relevant to current times and does so in a futuristic manner so that you can create your own rules, you can create your own universe. But a lot of the issues are very concrete. And Q is in the Star Trek universe is immortal. And in one of the more recent episodes or movies, Q is so bored, he wants to die and he can't. And he becomes quite desperate. And so if you think about, okay, I'd like to live to be 150. What about 3,000? And also think about the sclerotic impact it would have on society. If George Washington were still alive, would we want George Washington to be in charge of society? I don't think so, because George Washington's, although I think one of the great men of history, his culture, his social values were of his era. And society has to be dynamic and ever-changing. And of course, if you have people living immortally, you're going to end up with a power structure that isn't going to want to give up its power. We see that now when people aren't living immortally. But the good news is that whole immortality project is a fantasy, in my opinion. It is a utopian dream. And again, I don't think it will ever happen. But the value system it causes and spawns could be very destructive. and could lead to people needing help, not getting it, and people who really don't need help using all the resources to, in a desperate effort to stay alive longer. We see, for example, in Silicon Valley now, some I've read where one particularly, I don't remember his name, but very well-off, you know, billionaire, actually pays young people for their blood because he believes if he gets transfusions of youthful blood, it will help him live longer and healthier. So that's a very minor, it's exploitation, but it's a minor approach to exploitation. You could end up with buying organs, and which there's some real impetus now towards allowing that and this kind of thing, where you end up with very rich, well-off people taking advantage of people who become quite desperate. I also worry about what I call Blade Runner world, if you've seen the movie, where you have very well-off, connected, technologically adept people living very rich lives behind high walls, and the rest of the world kind of caught up in this anarchy that has no values whatsoever.
Right. And this reminds me, this conversation of mortality and immortality reminds me of, you know, in the Catholic Church, and I know that in Orthodox faith too, there's keeping your mortality at the forefront. You know, some of the saints used to put skull heads on their desks so they could be reminded that they're actually going to die. But even if we were to remain immortal, it doesn't solve the problem of human suffering, as you mentioned. And I think that sometimes people conflate immortality with lack of suffering, but that's not the case. As you said, suffering is part of the human problem. And so that continues.
It's part of the human condition. And it is also something that allows us to reach out to each other in love, to try to succor people who are going through extremists. We've all had difficulties, some more than others. And how often have you heard, well, the only way I was able to get through that was because I was helped by people who loved me.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's very important. Is there something fundamentally human about our embodied limits, something that shouldn't be escaped?
I think so. I think that, you know, if the future, if what comes next is wonderful, then you'd be denying yourself that wonder. But I think that, as I said earlier, the fact that we are finite, I think actually is a positive thing for living a meaningful and a life of love, service, and meaning.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, like the song, Live Like You Are Dying, right? Basically, live each day as if it's your last day, because we don't actually know. And as you mentioned, right now, that's just an idea, or this futuristic idea of living forever is just an idea. It's not moored in reality here. Many transhumanists believe we must enhance human intelligence, as you mentioned, to keep up with artificial intelligence. How central is cognitive enhancement to their vision, and what developments have they made to reach that vision?
It's a core element of transhumanism, and part of it is for us to keep up with AI, but actually what many transhumanists want is for us to merge with AI. So the idea would be that we would become not truly a human species anymore, because we would be partially technological. And the feeling is, and the thoughts are, that if you become more intelligent, that means you can increase technological potency. And if you increase technological potency, you become more likely to be able to attain immortality or make the changes that you think will make for a satisfactory life. But again, this is a utopian vision, and utopianism is very dangerous, particularly if it pursues something that is not pursuing human equality. Now, sometimes transhumanists will say about the point I just made, well, then we have to actually have the government pay for all of this for all people. Well, yeah, and then I say, well, where's that money going to come from? It's not realistic. And you see some of them talk about, well, we're going to end up having a segregation between the enhanced and the unenhanced. And the enhanced will take good care of the unenhanced. Well, yeah, right. It is just something that, again, I think is occupying people, giving them hope, because their core belief system doesn't have any. Now, there are some things called like Christian transhumanists or Buddhist transhumanists, But those are oxymoronic because a Christian isn't looking for immortality in this world. A Christian is hoping for immortality through faith in the New Jerusalem, which is the next world or the next plane of existence. Buddhists do not say, oh, we have to overcome suffering. Buddhists actually say, the way you overcome suffering is to realize that this world, this material world, is an illusion. So a true Buddhist isn't trying to say, well, I'll manipulate this world so that I suffer less. A true Buddhist is trying to say, I understand that this world doesn't really exist. It's an illusion. And the way to overcome suffering is to get past the fiction of what I'm seeing and experiencing and get to a place of calm and peace. But it also does away with what's called the duality. That means no joy. If joy is an illusion too in Buddhism, as well as pain and suffering. So, I mean, Buddhism says suffering is an illusion. Transhumanism says suffering is real and has to be overcome. Those are not compatible. Christianity says, yes, there will be immortality, but it's going to be immortality through Christ in the New Jerusalem, which isn't what we're experiencing now. Transhumanists say, we're going to have what we're experiencing now and create an earthly New Jerusalem that will allow us to have immortality in the physical corporeal world. Those are conflicting worldviews. And I don't understand, sometimes Christian transhumanists get really mad at me, but I don't understand how those two can be held together because I don't think they can.
Absolutely. And of course, the Christian idea, the Christian belief is not only that we aim for and strive for immortality in the world to come, but that at the second coming, our bodies, our physical bodies and our souls will be reunited and we will have immortality. And that is the Christian belief. But for the time being, seeking the immortality in the life to come after death is what's available to us until the second coming. So you spoke about this direct brain machine interface, and you said that, well, if the government potentially covered it, then there would be quote unquote equality. But obviously, even if the government covered it, it wouldn't make it moral, right? Combining this AI into our physical bodies, and Elon Musk's Neuralink is working on this direct brain machine interface. Is this therapeutic medicine or the first step towards merging humans with machines?
Both. As I said, this stuff can be a double-edged sword. You know, some of the implants that Elon Musk has championed and furthered, you know, have helped people with total paralysis be able to interact with the world better. You have implants that actually allow paralyzed people to move robotic arms with their thoughts, and therefore would lead to increased independence. I mean, that's quite positive. On the other hand, if you're trying to say, well, we're going to create part human, part cyborg, that's totally different. The disabled person who is receiving a tool to help him or her interact more beneficially in the world is not a post-human person any more than the glasses I'm wearing, which are a tool and help me correct vision faults, that's not transhumanism. Sometimes transhumanists will say, well, you wear glasses, that's transhumanism. No, it's not changing human nature. And the implants are not changing human nature when used for that purpose. But if you're using it for a purpose to create a post-human and somebody who is no longer part of the species Homo sapiens, well, that is different. And that is eugenics, because you think you can say which human attributes are better than other human attributes. And once you say, well, these capacities make us more human or better than human versus people without those capacities, well, then you've really got a problem. And I like to think of, in this discussion, people with Down syndrome. People, transhumanists will say, well, we have to have the highest level of intelligence possible. We're all super geniuses. Well, you look at people with Down syndrome, they've got developmental disabilities, but I have never seen a group of people more with a greater capacity to love and bigger hearts than people with Down syndrome. So are we going to say, I mean, if you wanted to say which of those attributes is superior, I'd say the Down syndrome capacity to love is superior, because that's the most highest virtue, I think, in humanity that we can express is true and selfless love. Transhumanism isn't about selflessness. It's about selfishness. It's about me, me, I. And that leads us down destructive paths.
Yes, so powerfully said. Futurists like Ray Kurzweil predict the singularity by 2045.
He used to say 2035.
Is that what?
No, used to say that. Now it's 2045, okay. Yeah.
Okay, so now it's 2045. What assumptions underlie that prediction now?
I think, again, and it is an incredibly fast-paced improvement in AI technology, the growth of other technological prowess, biotechnology, and so forth. He works at Google, or worked at Google, and he knows what they're up to. So he believes that all of this technological advances will eventually take over everything, and then it's just going to be a matter of sitting back and letting it happen. I don't deny that, you know, we'll have tremendous technological advances, but I don't think it'll be a singularity. And if it is a singularity, I think we should be alarmed, because that would mean humans are no longer in control, but technology is. And I don't think that's something to be devoutly wished.
That would be a scary world where AI and technology is ruling humans as opposed to the other way around. If enhancement technologies become available, you mentioned this before, but there is a chance of having two groups of people, the quote unquote enhanced people and the natural people. What kinds of risks does that bring onto society when you divide people?
Well, if you look at human history, it means those who are deemed inferior can be quickly viewed as objects to be exploited or oppressed or eliminated. I don't think any of that can possibly be benign. Even today, where human exceptionalism is more readily granted, not nearly enough, we still have the problem of discrimination and creating invidious distinctions based on irrelevant characteristics such as skin color. So, if we have that problem now, when you still have, at least in the West, a predominant Judeo-Christian human equality ethos, and there's still at least the lingua franca is universal human rights, and we still have those problems, imagine if we do away with the concept of human exceptionalism and universal human rights and start saying greater rights for the enhanced, and we'll take good care of the naturals. That could lead to terrible oppression, and human history shows that. I mean, why was slavery evil? Slavery and is evil because there's still slavery in the world, but I'm talking about the American version of slavery based on race. It was evil, profoundly evil, because it took inherent equals and treated them as if they were not equal. And by defining the people with African heritage as less than white people, that meant that we could then use them as beasts of burden and so forth. And that was one of the profound evils, in my view, in human history. And it came directly from denying human exceptionalism. The same thing in the eugenics movement. The eugenics movement of the late 19th century into the 60s divided human beings between the fit and the unfit. And that led to terrible oppression. For example, in the United States, more than 60,000 people were involuntarily sterilized because they were deemed unfit. And one of the great evil U.S. Supreme Court rulings was Buck v. Bell in 1927. Carrie Buck was a woman who was the daughter of a prostitute who had been brought in into a foster family. She was raped, got pregnant, and the foster family, rather than protecting Carrie Buck, put her into a mental institution where the eugenicists said, well, look at this. You have a daughter of a prostitute giving birth out of wedlock. This proves that eugenics is right. And it went to the Supreme Court to whether she could be sterilized. And Oliver Wendell Holmes said, three generations of idiots are enough. and in an 8-1 decision, allowed Carrie Buck to be sterilized when she had done nothing wrong. And that opened the floodgates. It's interesting that the Nuremberg codes of Nazi Germany were based on California's eugenics laws. So you ended up, when you created invidious distinctions between the fit and the unfit, which was based on things such as physical capacities and so forth, race. Margaret Sanger was a terrible racist. She was a eugenicist. But also on things such as, quote, moral actions, being drunk, being a drunkard, and this kind of thing. And you ended up with tremendous oppression of people in the freest parts of the world, England and United States and Canada, not to mention in Germany later on. So you can see what happens when you reject human exceptionalism. It does not lead to any place that is beneficial or that is sanguine.
It's horrific. And it actually reminds me of the movie Gattaca too, where people just scanned their fingers, et cetera, and their genetic code would come up, right? So that you could tell who was quote unquote enhanced, who wasn't. And as you mentioned, history has shown us, is replete with examples of how people are disregarded and mistreated when you have that kind of eugenic mentality. And so in the context of today's conversation about transhumanism, we can see what road transhumanism would go down if there were people who are quote unquote enhanced and then the naturals. And speaking of this manufacturing and designing of the next generation, transhumanism isn't just about aiming to enhance adults, as you mentioned. It also envisions manufacturing future generations. And so we've already done an episode on quote unquote designer babies. But what do you see as the key concerns in that aspect?
Well, when you decide that you're going to genetically engineer your baby for enhancement, as opposed to, let's say, when maybe we can knock out a gene that causes Huntington's disease, which would be therapeutic, you end up in a situation where you're actually destroying human freedom. Because, for example, let's say that you decided you were a fundamentalist religious person and you wanted to make sure your children were fundamentalist religious people, and that there was a genetic component to that belief or that approach to life or that sense of self. And the genetic enhancement, quote unquote, was made. Well, you've destroyed that child's freedom to choose whether to be a person of faith or not. Same thing would be true. Let's say we find that a great musical genius came through being able to find genes that would reflect that. Well, I'm going to make sure that my child is a concert pianist of the highest order, and so I'm going to genetically alter the child to do that. Well, you've destroyed that child's freedom, perhaps to pursue other approaches to living. And so basically, when you start doing that, the child becomes part of the transhumanist ideal of being able to manipulate and control, because that's what a lot of this is about, future actions and capacities. And the child then becomes more of a instrument of making the transhumanist happy than the child becoming happy him or herself. And it really is a loss of unconditional love, because the reason you might love the child is if the child has those capacities, let's say, that I wish I had. You know, maybe a great baseball player. I didn't even make Little League. I mean, I want my child to be a Babe Ruth. So I'm going to genetically manipulate the child. Well, eventually that takes away the idea of human excellence, doesn't it? Because rather than human excellence coming from character and work and practice and training and concentrated effort, oh, we take a pill or we do this little adjustment. And eventually it's not going to solve the problem, because even if the capacities increased, you'd still have that kind of race for even higher capacities. But transhumanism doesn't even, I think, acknowledge the importance of human virtues. And it doesn't acknowledge that the struggle is part of what makes us human and part of what makes life worth living. When we see people in the Olympics doing tremendously incredible things, what would it mean if they could do those incredible things just based on having some kind of technological jiggering done? What makes us gasp in awe is we know the effort that went into being able to do that. And I think that's really important to acknowledge excellence as a human attribute based on human effort, not based on technological quick fixes.
And this brings a lot of questions too. Obviously, in the Olympics or any professional sports, they do drug testing. They see what kind of enhancements have those people taken to help them perform better. It's an interesting question as to if you introduce quote unquote enhanced humans into that equation. Obviously, it's not a level playing field anymore. But also, as you said, what does it do to our own nature to reach these levels in sports or other areas? And you know, it's all pushed technologically, but not according to our nature. And I think that that's a big component of it. We already talked about cloning, but genetic engineering, there's other developments, and we'll have complete shows on these too, but genetic engineering, artificial wombs, et cetera, those are other technologies that are in the works. And another thing to mention is that what you are speaking about creating future children with certain qualities, you're actually consumerizing children. You're making children products. Yep. that can fit your vision or not. And so what do you do if a child turns out differently from what you imagined? It's not like you would quote unquote return. There's no refund policy, right? But it kind of creates a dynamic between parents and children that shouldn't be there, where it's more of a consumerist attitude as opposed to the love that you spoke about.
If procreation becomes an issue of manufacture, which is what you're basically saying, then that leads to quality control, doesn't it? Because any kind of manufacturer, you want to have the best product possible. And in terms of you can't return it, well, we see now with surrogacy, which I think is a form of transhumanism, that women who are carrying babies that turn out to have, for example, Down syndrome, are pressured to abort. And in some country, particularly the Netherlands now, if a child is born with a serious disability, they will be euthanized in their bassinet under what's called the Groningen Protocol, Groningen. So we already have a concept potentially, well, this is not the baby I wanted, let's return that child, which of course would mean destroy that child and start again. It also, that kind of approach to having children is not about unconditional love, but again, it's about fulfilling the desires I want as a parent to have in my child. And that isn't to say that all parents don't want their children to have certain, you know, capacities or certain talents and so forth. But when you try to manipulate the child through the naked power of gene editing or other kind of biotechnological effort, that's completely different. And takes, as I said, I think it takes away the human freedom that each of us is entitled to.
Absolutely. And in a prior episode, we talked about the harms of germline engineering because it affects future generations, and those edits end up in the children of children who have had this. And so it completely changes the human genome altogether. But are there tools? So could genetic engineering or artificial wombs, could they be neutral tools, or are they expressions of a deeper philosophy? How do we use new technologies in a good moral way versus a way that leads us down the path of transhumanism and are used immorally?
I think you have to set up good science requires both technological advances and ethics. And I think that, of course, there are benign and beneficial uses of some of these technologies. For example, the CRISPR gene editing technology. If you use it to enhance an early embryo and engage in germline genetic engineering based on a eugenics kind of approach, as you said, that can go down the generations. But if you engage in somatic CRISPR, meaning an adult with a genetic problem receives a genetic treatment that alleviates that problem, well, that's like a medical treatment. And we've already seen it with CRISPR in early studies that they've done for the gene that causes sickle cell anemia that can lead to great pain. Gene editing with CRISPR has actually alleviated a tremendous amount of the pain associated with that disease. It hasn't cured the disease, but it has had a tremendous benefit going forward. So you can't, and by the way, you know, there's sometimes unintended consequences. We don't know the impact that some of these manipulations might have on future generations. My understanding of sickle cell anemia is that it's also related to the ability to withstand and push back against malaria. So it's possible that if you genetically manipulate the gene that causes sickle cell anemia, you might also, particularly if it's germline genetic engineering, make it easier for people to catch malaria. I don't know that if that's true or not, but I'm saying these kinds of things can happen. If you do it in a way that doesn't pass down the generations, realizing that sometimes you're going to engage in human experimentation in a proper way that can lead to benefit or can lead to harm, that's a different thing because it's based on treating that particular patient. I think a strong line needs to be created between therapeutic and enhancing purposes. And then, of course, defining those terms becomes difficult because they're, again, getting to this idea that, a primary drive in society now is to eliminate suffering. The flip side of that is I have a right to be happy and to use these interventions to make me happy. And so the idea that something is therapeutic that I would say is enhancing. Some might say, well, that's therapeutic because that's what I need to make me happy. So we're going to have a serious societal discussion of how to distinguish between those two different purposes for these technologies. And what worries me, and I really appreciate that you're discussing these issues on your podcast, is that most people aren't thinking about them. The media is certainly not reporting it. The government doesn't engage it too much, a little bit on AI, I suppose, to promote AI. But you don't see any kind of international discussions about how, like we saw with the splitting of the atom, how do we control this technology to promote the beneficial aspects and try to prevent the less beneficial aspects. And I think we have a lack of self-restraint also among many in transhumanists and among the scientific community, where they're going to do it because they want to do it, and there's nothing that can be done to stop them if they get the funding. So I think that we're in an era of solipsism where what I want is what matters. And that is something that technology can't fix. What has to fix that approach are things that are not about hard science, but about faith and morality and philosophy.
Absolutely. And I think the distinction between therapeutic and enhancing is very important in this discussion. And as you said, right now, there aren't many limits in terms of both personal limits that a scientist could have if a scientist wants to go down the route of kind of pushing the envelope on these issues, but also in terms of the laws there are. I think that just depending on which country, some countries allow more of this experimentation than other countries, but really it's the Wild West, and so I think that there needs to be limits put in place to make sure that we don't go down this road.
Yeah, right now we have voluntary guidelines, which are, as one person once said, they're worth the paper they're written on. He said about an oral contract, it's worth the paper it's written on. So are guidelines, because the guidelines work except for people who don't want to follow them. And that's why we've actually had genetically engineered babies born in China, because China is the place where ethics goes to die. There's tremendous human rights abuses there, and a lot of times, if something can't be done, let's say here in the United States, people will go to China to do it because China has a much more transactional approach. And China doesn't believe in human exceptionalism, the CCP. I'm not talking about Chinese people, but the Communist Party, the leadership, very instrumental in their approach and materialistic. And you can see that with the genocide of the Uyghurs and the organ harvesting of the Falun Gong and so forth, the attempt to destroy churches and all aspects of faith in China, that when you give up on human exceptionalism and when you think of human beings in a purely materialistic way, that can lead to instrumentalization of people and even their oppression and killing.
It's really horrific. And again, as you mentioned, in China, ethics goes to die and human rights go to die. And so we have to, I think, as an international community, put limits on China, because human beings in China have a right for their lives to be protected and not to be exploited. And we know that there's a lot of exploitation going on in China. On a different topic, when you were talking about enhancement, is all enhancement eugenic, or are there types of enhancement that are not eugenic?
I think if you're trying to improve something based on like looks, intelligence, physical strength, these kinds of things, I think they are eugenics. Now, not all eugenics efforts lead to the same evil outcome. But as I said earlier, it isn't the technology that about transhumanism that scares me, but the value system. And I think that we really do have to try to say, well, I want to, right now with IVF, they're actually companies saying, well, I can make sure your child is blonde, for example. And those things are semi-benign, except you're tossing out the embryos that don't match the quality control. So I think eugenics, I think enhancement of normal human capacities or development is inherently eugenics. And eugenics leads to terrible places, even though every eugenics manipulation might not, you know, in that particular case, result in evil, the value system does.
I totally agreed on that point. Do transhumanists believe that if we were to create the quote-unquote post-humans or the enhanced humans, do they in their principal system believe that those humans would have greater moral worth than natural humans?
Some will say so, and some might deny it. Some might say, well, it would just give the enhanced humans would just have the obligation to take care of the poor naturals. But that's not how life works. And that's certainly not human nature, is it?
Right. Exactly. And obviously, the principle of human equality just go out the window.
By definition, in transhumanism, it's not about human equality. It's about a superman mentality, that the greater I enhance myself, the better I am. And that, as I said in the example with Down syndrome, isn't true. I think people with Down syndrome have some of the greatest human qualities that we see on the planet.
Exactly. You spoke earlier about the fact that we should try to mitigate suffering and help people who are suffering. But this idea, this transhumanist idea of eliminating suffering completely at all costs, why is this kind of utopian thinking so dangerous?
Well, because it leads to the idea, as expressed by Aubrey de Grey, that if you interfere with the transhumanist quest, it's akin to terrorism. And that means you're justified in fighting back. As Zoltan Isfahan saying, war would be justified if a country was trying to prevent transhumanist advances. And Zoltan's a really, I like him. He's a nice guy. He's sort of a friend. I mean, we've engaged with each other for a long time, cross swords, if you will. I've had him on my podcast twice now, but he's admitted that's his thinking. So in the end, if you're utopian, then whatever is required to attain the goal becomes justified. And that leads to tremendous harm and evil. As history shows us, the Bolsheviks were utopian. The French Revolution, I think, is a classic example. The French Revolution and the American Revolution are two different categories. The American Revolution was about reform. The French Revolution was utopian, so it destroyed everything that came before it in order to build this perfect society. And what did you end up with after the French Revolution? Napoleon. So utopianism doesn't work well. And my theory is that the French Revolution was one of the greatest catastrophes in human history, certainly since the emergence of the West. And the French Revolution begat the Bolshevik Revolution, which begat the Cultural Revolution in China, which led to millions of deaths. And all of that was this utopian ideal that we'll make a perfect society on Earth. That can't happen. It won't happen. But again, the ends justify the means in utopianism, and the means often become very destructive of what even you believe the ends should be. and eventually the means become the ends, and you end up with true devastation.
And this is why we're doing this episode on transhumanism, because as history has shown us, it doesn't work out for us, and this should become a cautionary tale to try to prevent us going down the road that is unmoored from morality, from ethics.
And you can have advances, and certainly should have advances in technology with human exceptionalism.
Right.
I mean, there's tremendous benefit we've seen in the last 100 years. For example, just the polio vaccine is an example. The polio vaccine, I'm old enough to remember when kids got polio, and I was terrified of it as a little boy. And I remember the children in these iron lung wards. So the polio vaccine eradicated that. But it didn't change human nature. It just gave us the ability to fight off the polio virus. So we're not saying we're anti-technological advances by any stretch, but we are saying that technology should be pursued and advances attained through human exceptionalist belief systems and ethics and morality, rather than an anything goes solipsistic lack of self-restraint that says, if I can figure out how to do it, I should do it. I mean, would we drop an atomic bomb on the moon? I would hope not. And the reason isn't scientific. You could gain some scientific knowledge doing that. The reason is ethical and moral.
Exactly. And with human exceptionalism comes the fact that we have human rights. We must respect human beings, and all of the, you know, the ends don't justify the means. All of those types of moral principles that we've discussed in different episodes all come into play here, because we can't progress without having the right framework, having humans and human rights at the center, at the core of all decision making, and to make sure that we respect human rights at the core. Some of the transhumanist advocates favor expanded surveillance and predictive technologies for optimization. Does that threaten fundamental human rights and liberties?
Yes. Next question. Of course. And you can see where does that come from? That comes from the belief that this is the most important thing that can be done, because this is the only chance I have to not die. And therefore, whatever it takes to attain what I'm looking for should be done. It's a classic utopian approach, isn't it?
Yes, but we've already accepted some surveillance, right? A lot of us have Alexas in our home and Nests for alarm systems, et cetera. So yep. How much surveillance do we allow into our private lives, and how do we still protect human rights and liberties?
We don't have to have, I won't say her name because I have one in my office here. I don't want the A person, who's not a person, but the A program to wake up and start asking me what I want. But I don't have to have that. I have that, which I know perhaps interferes with my privacy, because there's a great deal of benefit I get from it. But none of that is a moral problem. When you start having mass surveillance by the state, and we're always going to have some, because you have to have order and you have to have people protected, but that can lead to, you know, a surveillance state leads to tyranny. Again, I hate to go back to China, but China is a classic example, I think, of a transhumanist society, because they have the social credit system. And in the social credit system of China, China uses AI, it uses facial recognition technologies and so forth to give you points or detract points from your score, depending on what you do. So if a Chinese person goes to church, they lose points because religion is frowned upon. If the Chinese person works overtime, they might gain points. And in China, in the social credit system, if you have acted in ways that the government deems antisocial, you could lose your ability to work. You could, because it's all in a app on your phone. You can lose your ability to even ride the train, and your children can be impacted. So I think China is actually creating the most effective tyranny in the history of the world, because, for example, they're telling Christians you know, Christians are used to martyrdom. I mean, that's been part of the faith since the beginning. And they'll say, well, if you believe in Christ and, you know, espouse Christ, you're going to go to prison and we might kill you. And the really devout Christian might say, bring it on. But if the government says, and we'll make it so your children can't get a job, which means they'll never get married, which means that they're going to always be social outcasts, that's a different thing altogether. And that's the kind of thing that the social credit system is enabling.
And that's really scary. I think China is really a good example of this and how a transhumanist society becomes authoritarian. And you've already mentioned the social credit system that exists in China. But also we've seen the limits on reproduction. China can control how many children people have, even if parents are quote unquote worthy of becoming parents, etc. There's a lot that can happen when you have that kind of a surveillance on you. And this is part and parcel with what transhumanists believe.
Well, you've already described the idea of getting a license to have a child. That's actually been proposed by some transhumanist articles. And I want to get back to China just again for a second, because there's something, a deep irony that I think really explains when you try to have hyper control, what can happen. So for many decades, the China government imposed a one child system on China, and forced abortion was part of that, and infanticide was part of that. And they ended up with a demographic disaster. So they said, oh, well, let's make it so you can have three children. Well, right now, you know, when you try to manipulate things like that from on high, you're going to end up with a terrible problem. And so they're trying to fix what they caused, and it's perhaps unfixable. And the same thing would happen here if we ended up with the kind of, and there is an attempt, I think, to kind of create a more benign, perhaps, but certainly a social credit system in the United States and in the West. You've seen efforts now, we're going to censor certain ideas, particularly in Western Europe, you see that. We're going to prevent people from having free expression. We're going to prevent certain categories of candidates from even running because we think they're too extreme. And so you end up with a where technology, and again, this is not necessarily transhumanism, but technology can lead to the old human desire to have control over, particularly among those who are in power, to increase their power. Transhumanism and the technological advances that are proposed would allow the power, people in power, the power elite, to have hyper power over what they have now. And the only way to prevent that is through ethics and morality, to say we're not going to do those things because we believe in human freedom. And of course, human freedom actually leads to greater scientific advances than controlled efforts that we see in China, for sure, but also in beginning to happen in the West. China's doing very well technologically, there's no question, but a lot of it is because they stole our technology.
And also because they're doing experimentation on human beings that is exploitative and immoral. I think that you can't base progress when your means is immoral.
And karma exists, or the as you sow, so shall you reap, I think is a pretty ironclad rule of the universe. And if you end up sowing seeds that are based on that kind of destructive approach, you're going to reap the whirlwind. And it's very dangerous. I think that the idea that we can have that kind of control in society is delusionary and leads to places, the unintended consequence. And then to think that we have the ability to decide which human being is better than another is hubristic in the extreme. And I would remind people that we are the species that created the unsinkable ship Titanic. These things have profound consequences, particularly when you turn them from perhaps an individual initiative to societal quests. And you have to have ethics and morality to maintain a proper approach to science advancement and protecting the human species.
Absolutely. You said people, transhumanism may never arrive, but its values already have.
Yes.
Can you give examples of where those values have already taken root today?
Well, the transgender movement, I think, is classic. Mm-hmm. And as I said in that first transhumanist convention I went to, or symposium, it was brought up specifically. So, you know, the idea of personal recreationism, that it what I am is not who I am, but what I feel I really am. And so I feel that I'm actually part chimp. Well, then I should be able to make myself part chimp because it'll give me greater upper body strength. In the transgender movement, you have people for whom we should have great sympathy and empathy who feel they are not the sex they were born. And particularly when it comes to children, we now see, and it's beginning to abate, I hope, but you've seen tremendous harm done to children in the name of, well, I feel I'm a girl, but I feel I'm a boy. And you've seen double mastectomies. You've seen children getting facial reconstruction surgery. You've seen natural puberty blocked through drugs, cross-sex hormones, things that will impact these children in adulthood for the rest of their lives. If you have genital surgeries, you're a patient forever, particularly if you go from male to, quote, female, quote, because the artificial vagina needs to constantly be dealt with. And you're also causing sterility and so forth. So I think that the transgender movement is an early expression of transhumanist values.
Yes, and we've done shows precisely on those risks and effects of both the puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, surgeries on people who have gotten them and the terrible effects. And a lot of them are irreversible harms that are done on people's bodies and their fertility, as you mentioned. Are there other technological ways? Have they made any developments in the brain technology barrier, et cetera, that we should be aware of, as, for example, Neuralink's mission is?
Well, I think, as we said earlier, that some of these developments have been very salutary. The idea of helping people with disabilities control their environment is wonderful. I don't believe yet, and I hope it never happens, that there's been a merging of AI with human existence to create a different category of life. And that's what we should prevent.
Of course. You mentioned before that it's this idea, the transhumanist idea is based on the I want philosophy, the individual desire. Why is placing individual desire not the way that we should move forward as a society? And why should we not use individual desire as the highest moral claim?
Well, individual desire, and we might even call it ambition, is great when directed in a positive and wholesome way. But if it becomes, I have a right to alter my body in any way I want, I have a right to change society in such a way that we are no longer a cohesive whole, oh, that's completely different. Personal desire and ambition is, again, part of the human condition. But when it becomes the be-all and end-all and becomes the justification for doing things that might harm others or might cause society harm or even my own self-harm, then you've got a problem. So again, the issue, I think, and I'm really coming to believe this after many decades dealing with these kinds of issues, the real only hope for us, Serena, is self-restraint. We have to be human is to know what we should do and what we shouldn't do. That gets into the idea of human duties and human obligations and morality. We need to be able to engage in personal self-restraint. Let me give you an example. Thank God at this point I don't have this issue, but let's assume that the only way I could stay alive is a liver transplant. Now, let's say I could go to China and get a liver transplant in 5 days if I took $100,000, which, by the way, people can. Should I do it? Some would say, well, you're going to die if you don't. That justifies anything. Well, I hope I would not believe that. I hope that even though my death might be the consequence, that I wouldn't go to China and have someone killed to save my life. So that's what I'm talking about. The idea that there are things worse than death needs to be continued, because there are. And if you believe at all that how you live this life will affect what comes after you're not in this life anymore, which I do, but even if I didn't, I hope that my morality and my belief in the importance of my fellow man and woman would preclude me from paying $100,000 to have someone killed so I could live. That would be evil in the extreme. And so that's what I'm talking about in terms of self-restraint. Some people are desperate to have children. We can engage these very radical reproductive technologies. And I've criticized some of them, and I've had people write me, I would do anything to have a child. And I've replied, well, I'm sorry, but isn't that the problem? That you would do anything. We shouldn't be willing to do anything to get what we want. We should, of course, want what we want and pursue our goals, ambitions, and our desires, but there have to be limits beyond which we will not go, and that takes self-restraint. And I think self-restraint right now is the primary human peer pressure that doesn't exist anymore. We've done away with the idea of expecting people to restrain themselves, and I think that needs to be reintroduced into society without making it oppressive so that people can't actually have a free life, you know?
Right. Absolutely. And I think that not only the idea of self-restraint, but what you mentioned earlier, which is that we have human rights, but with those rights come responsibilities. We have responsibilities right. towards our own bodies. We also have responsibilities towards other people. And so there needs to be that interaction and decision-making based on those responsibilities, which also come with rights.
And we have to think as much or more than feel. Right now, everything is about feelings. In fact, in the way we speak about things, well, I feel like this or that, or I feel President Trump is good, or I feel President Trump is bad. No, feelings are different than thinking. And we have to change our language to say, I think President Trump is good, or I think President Trump is bad, because thinking, and not just Trump, obviously, but thinking means that you've thought through principles and you have value systems that you can apply to a situation as it arises. If what I decide is right is based on what I feel, then what I feel today can be completely different than what I feel tomorrow. And the whole idea of principle becomes sand that you can't build the house on in the old biblical proverb. Feelings have their place, and feelings are part of the human condition, but they shouldn't be the controlling aspect of humanity. And I think in terms of transhumanism, feeling, that fear, raw fear of death, that raw fear of inadequacy, that desire to have hyper-control is based on feelings and not thought.
Right. And even thought could be wrong, right? If your conscience is not informed, if you haven't studied the frameworks that should be in place in making decisions, especially moral decision-making, for example, that the ends don't justify the means, et cetera, then even your thoughts could be incorrect. And so it's not about feelings, but it's also about having an informed mind and informed framework as well.
Correct.
In these decisions that people make. So going back to that idea, transhumanists, if they believe that we're just advanced carbon molecules, or as you mentioned earlier, meet computers, or just biology and data, do they have any framework for what should ground our human rights?
Not in my opinion. I mean, their framework is that, in fact, they've got declarations of transhumanist rights and this kind of thing, and that the rights are based on the ability to engage in these transactions that we've been discussing. You know, the right to become immortal, the right to change your body, the right to change your offspring, and this kind of thing. So their rights are based on to fulfill the transhumanist goals and desires one might have. And they also try to expand the concept of rights to machines, AI. They want AIs to become persons and have rights. They also, it's interesting in terms of that suffering question, I've seen transhumanists give speeches that they should upload animals into cyberspace to prevent suffering, or they should make it so predators no longer want to predate. And so this idea, which of course will never happen, but the idea of that kind of control, I think is neurotic.
Yes. Is any part of transhumanism compatible with human dignity?
You know, I don't think so. I've never been asked that question. But because transhumanism, by definition, denies human exceptionalism, that means it's denying intrinsic human dignity. And intrinsic human dignity means that somebody like Terry Schiavo, in a severely cognitive decline or injured state, has the same moral value as you and I do. That's human exceptionalism. That the person of color has the same moral value as anyone else. Of course, that's human exceptionalism. That's human equality. When you deny human exceptionalism, you are denying intrinsic dignity. And then it's kind of like you begin to eat your own tail. You see things like, well, we're going to give cyber AI rights, or we're going to give, and rights have already been granted to 8 rivers in this world in the nature rights movement, geological features. Human rights are part of the human condition, and I don't think a post-human situation would be something that would promote universal human rights, because it would, again, be based on eugenic ideas of capacities and superiority versus inferiority.
Very, very succinctly and well said. As we mentioned, obviously, technologies and advancements can be good and most often are, depending on how they're used and how they're created, et cetera. But how can we pursue innovation without losing sight of human dignity?
Again, setting up proper ethics, having a proper moral value system, agreeing that, in fact, you know, we've had some of that. The Nuremberg Code came out of the horrors of the Nazi medical Holocaust. And was set forth by the Nuremberg Tribunal to do the very thing that you asked about, to set up proper parameters around scientific research. The Common Code right now, the Common Rule, I'm sorry, does that for human research. So the idea that when you violate it, you end up with things like the Tuskegee atrocity, where African-American men were told they were being treated for syphilis, but weren't. And because the scientists decided they wanted to see what would happen if syphilis carried out until death. I mean, that's a denial of human intrinsic dignity. So all scientific advancement needs to be based on the idea of human exceptionalism, human intrinsic dignity. Also, the idea of, I mean, if we engage in, we should engage in animal research to the least extent possible, consistent with human advancing. And there are always going to be times when we might, because of the need for self-restraint, not have an advancement we might otherwise have had because we've decided that the moral cost is greater than the potential scientific advancement.
Yes. If you were to speak to a transhumanist right now, what would you communicate as an alternative vision for human flourishing?
That he should or she should focus on the entirety of the human experience, not just the material aspect of human experience, that I would urge them to look and research into faith. I'm a Christian, and I would suggest Christianity, but Buddhism has a tremendous philosophy that leads to benign places. I would urge them to not think of death as the ultimate horror, but perhaps eternal life in the corporeal state as a greater horror because of the ennui that would be inflicted upon the human person. If you were alive for 10,000 years, you would have done everything there is to be done. So I would urge them to understand that human life is more than news, weather, and sports in the sense of the material aspect of our lives, that some of the less material aspects of our lives are equally crucial. And I would have them look at the research that's ongoing, that the brain and the mind are not necessarily the same thing. People are trying to, a lot of very learned scientists are saying, wait a second, the mind is more than what can be found in the brain. So there's plenty of research being done that shows that the reductionist view of transhumanists, that all we are is strictly material, may not be true.
And what questions should listeners wrestle with before embracing transhumanist ideas?
Well, I hope they won't embrace transhumanist ideas, but they should ask themselves, what is the most important aspect of human life? Is it our love for each other, our belief in universal equality, our belief in the intrinsic human dignity, or is it attributes and capacities? And if we begin to believe that some people with greater capacities that we desire are better people, then we're going down a wrong path. We also, I think, need to have greater empathy for people, for example, who are getting elderly. This, as I said, is becoming of an interesting concern to me. But, you know, the idea that people become frail and are incapable necessarily of doing what they used to do when they were 30 doesn't change who they are as people and their inherent value. So I would urge people, when they decide how to pursue, whether it's medicine or whether it's you know, improving their ability to play baseball or whatever it is, to do so in a human way, not in a transhuman way.
Yes. And of course, our vulnerability is throughout our life. A baby is very vulnerable, very dependent on his or her parents, and someone who is elderly and more frail is very dependent on family and on society. And so I think that embracing our own vulnerability as people is very important. And even just recognizing that that's part of the human experience.
Exactly. You know, sometimes giving people care is important, but receiving care graciously is also important.
Yes. And lastly, what does it mean to be fully human, and why is that enough?
Oh, that's just a couple of sentences. This is Smith on this question. I think being fully human is to embrace the totality of human experience. And that would include, for me, faith. It would include love. It would include hopefully giving to others. It would include, as I said, when I need it, receiving gracious care graciously, of thinking about our posterity. You know, the founders of the United States were talking about their posterity all the time. That's us. And I think we should, part of living a fully human life is thinking about, how do I leave this world when I'm gone? And sorry, transhumanists, you will be gone at some point. Will the world have been better that I was here or not? And if we focus on those kinds of things, we'll make a more humane and a more compassionate society. And again, compassion means to suffer with. It doesn't mean to eliminate. And suffering with others, I think, is I think Mother Teresa is a classic example. It leads to saintly existence.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, accepting our human limitations and the fact that suffering will always be with us on this side of heaven. And so thank you for putting all that into perspective, Wesley, and for your knowledge on so many topics and for sharing your knowledge on transhumanism today. We will certainly have you back to talk about some of the other issues we discussed on animal rights and nature rights, etc. We're so grateful for your wisdom, for your knowledge, and for your presence. Thank you, Wesley.
Well, thank you for having me on, and congratulations on the success you're having with your podcast.
For my conversation with Wesley Smith, attorney, award-winning author, fellow at Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, and host of the Humanize podcast, here are my 5 key takeaways on transhumanism and the future of human dignity. 1. Transhumanism rejects human exceptionalism and replaces equality with capacity. At its core, transhumanism denies the intrinsic equal dignity of every human being. Instead of grounding human worth in our shared humanity, it elevates capacity, intelligence, strength, longevity, creating a framework that fractures equality and opens the door to eugenics. 2. The movement is driven by fear, not flourishing. Transhumanism is fueled by a deep fear of suffering and death. Rather than accepting human limits, it seeks to eliminate them through radical technological intervention. But when eliminating suffering becomes the highest good, eliminating the sufferer is never far behind. 3. Utopian thinking makes quote-unquote ends justify the means inevitable. When immortality or perfection becomes the ultimate goal, anything that stands in the way becomes an obstacle to remove. History shows that utopian visions often lead to oppression, exploitation, and tyranny. 4. The real crisis is loss of self-restraint. Transhumanism elevates I want into a moral principle. But human freedom without moral limits and responsibilities becomes destructive. The question isn't just what we can engineer, it's what we should. A civilization without self-restraint risks sacrificing its humanity for power. 5. Being fully human is enough. Human flourishing isn't about maximizing capacity, it's about embracing love, vulnerability, moral responsibility, and solidarity. Suffering, mortality, and dependence are not defects to your race, but realities that shape compassion, meaning, and the condition of being human. Because truth matters and human dignity isn't optional. This is Bioethics, Babe. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Bioethics, Babe podcast. If you've enjoyed this content, please subscribe to my YouTube channel and your favorite podcast platform and share with your friends and family. Also check out bioethicsbabe.com for the latest episodes and resources.